When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your day podcast for the big storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Monday, April 8th, week one of the 2024 clay court season, now officially in the books. I thoroughly enjoy the group of winners I get to discuss on today's podcast because it's not the typical pool of players you would expect to find success on the clay courts, particularly this early. You talk about making that transition from the quicker hard courts to the slower clay. Typically, a different skill set becomes that much more valuable to the players on court. Point construction, that much more significant when competing on clay courts. You don't just need a foot of space to try to attack. You need 3, 5, maybe even 7 feet of space because it's that much harder to hit through these grittier clay courts. You need to hit heavy topspin to try and have the ball rip through the court. Flat strokes just don't penetrate the court in the same way they do on the concrete, on the grass courts. And thus, again, it's typically not power-centric first-strike players finding success, let alone immediate success, as we make the transition across surfaces. And yet, that power-centric first-strike tennis, that was the prevailing playing style of, dare I say, 4 of the 5 players who found the winner's circle in week one of this clay court season. It has me wondering, have we reached an era where the weapons these players possess so immense that nowadays they can even rip through a clay court? Again, we only have, we have the 4 weeks of ATP clay court play from South America in February, but this is our first significant week of clay-focused data points, and thus all I can do is overreact to the first week of tennis I saw. That said, you look across the board, and I know in Charleston, Danielle Collins' success is on a different stratosphere. It's not just that her power-centric tennis is working, it's that it's worked 13 straight times. In her last 13 matches, she's 25-2 in overall sets, and again, she hasn't faced cupcake draws. No, what Danielle Collins has done over the last 3 weeks for someone who, again, at the start of the season announced that they were retiring at the end of the year, it is nothing short of breathtaking. For Collins to beat Jabeur, Stevens, Mertens, Sakkari, Kasatkina, and by the way, a good win over Bedosa in round one. She didn't get a bye in this event because she wasn't seeded coming into it either. That is a remarkable run of success to add on to, obviously, what she did in Miami as well. Like, Danielle Collins is probably the third best player in the world right now. Iga, Sabalenka, they get the benefit of the doubt. But, I mean, again, this three-week run of success, I think Serena in 08, 2013, according to our friends at Optase, the only other player this century to make that transition across surfaces so successfully, win Miami, Charleston back-to-back. Again, it's not just power-centric tennis that's working for Danielle Collins. Everything is working for her, but clearly that power was the prevailing theme that when looking at what propelled her to success, throughout the course of her week in Charleston. And so, obviously, we got to take a look at that. Everything else that emerged from what was a loaded first event of this 2024 clay court season on the women's side helps, of course, that they have this week off. So, and it's not that far from Miami, so might as well sneak in all the matches before making that transition to Europe. Anyways, we'll talk all things Charleston, but speaking of power-centric, you got to look at the men's side. Ben Shelton now has a clay court title. For him to win it in Houston in the fashion that he did, the point construction again, it wasn't about point construction. It was about aggression, his willingness, eagerness almost to push forward whenever possible. You know, again, so impressive to beat Tomas Martin-Echeverry, who made the quarterfinals of Roland Garros last year. I know Houston clay is different than European clay and Roland Garros clay in particular, but that's who Ben Shelton just beat on clay courts. Then he beat reigning Houston champion Francis Tiafoe, and a peer of his, obviously someone he looks up to. He talked about that openly in the trophy presentation. Beat him to win the title. And it was all power-centric. First strike, elite serving from Ben with, again, a mix-in of some of the improvisational skills that just make him such a captivating talent to see him find success. Hubie Hurkacz now, a clay court champion on the ATP Tour. He wins in Estoril, and there were times when his first strike, including the backhand return of serve, which was just at a level I don't know if he's ever hit on this surface before. He played elite first strike, dictating terms of play tennis. Obviously, Marrakesh, when you think first strike for the last half decade, you've probably thought of the Marrakesh champion, Matteo Berrettini, who, man, makes it very, like, apologies for the simple adverb there. But watching him play first strike tennis, it's a stark reminder that having weapons that allow you to control the tempo of play, it just really does make your life that much easier, especially if trying to return from an injury, especially if trying to regain top form, as Berrettini is. Oh my God. Like, watching him find his rhythm against Carbeas Baena in the final, then slowly but surely break down everything Carbeas Baena was trying to do and overwhelm it with the first forehand, the decisiveness with which he played. First strike tennis, again, the prevailing theme behind the success we saw in so much of week one of this 2024 clay court season. And then maybe the most exciting, if you are a tennis nerd in the most fashionable of senses, the thing that maybe got you most amped, I really thoroughly enjoyed, and it happened twice this week, to see Ben Shelton win on home soil in Houston. But then how about Cami Osorio, who wins her second Bogota title, to see her have success? Obviously, she's still, I think, 22 years old and has kind of fallen out of that elite conversation in terms of top-tier young prospects. And yet, again, just to see her forehand fly through the air in Bogota, to watch her, to watch the physicality she played with, the discipline she played with in her win over Bojkova in the final. It was a really fun first week. Plenty for me to overreact to here on today's show. So that is precisely what I want to do for all of you listeners, offer my thoughts on everything we saw unfold, in particular during championship weekend of week one of the 2024 clay court season. Of course, it's also Monte Carlo week, and we will start to turn our attention towards the first 1,000 level event on clay courts of the season here tomorrow. But also, just to, for you fans to note, what's going on right now here at Cracked Rackets. It's our final weekend of coverage on ESPN Plus of the 2024 college tennis season, at least as it relates to ACC and SEC regular season play. So if you haven't tuned in already, I am telling you, catch some college tennis before we get into May Madness, the NCAA tournament swing, the energy, the passion, the enthusiasm you see at the collegiate level. It's unmatched at any other level of the sport. Trust me, I see it. I see it all. I watch it all. It's just, again, there's a passion you play with when tennis turns into a team sport that perhaps reaches a level that I don't think is possible to reach at the individual when playing at an individual sport. And so, again, anyways, all that is to say, if you haven't already, tune in, ESPN Plus. We only have one event this week in Monte Carlo. You're going to have to watch some tennis at night if you're like me and need your fix. So we'll be there for you Friday, Sunday nights, ACC, SEC. We're also going to be on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on ESPN Plus with our Big 12 coverage this week. Big 10 coverage available on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. Recaps of every week of the D1 college tennis season live on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel Tuesday, Wednesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern time. So again, if you're ready to dip your toes in, feel free to tune in, of course, check out everything that's going on at the college tennis level. Of course, we've got some really fun interviews coming out on the Cracked Interviews podcast feed as well, so be on the lookout for them to drop this week. A shout-out, as always, to Westhoff for making everything possible. A shout-out, of course, as well, to all of you fans who tune in, day out, and a thank you to the support we get from our friends at Tennis Point, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15 for all of the latest and greatest products in the tennis world. All right, there's only one place we can start in recapping week one of the 2024 clay court season. That's in Charleston with the 13 now match win streak of Danielle Collins. Of course, how did she reach that? Well, six wins this week. And again, I know I've already listed the resume, but to beat Bedosa, Jabeur, Stevens, Mertens, Sakkari, and Adaria Kasatkina, who has been sneaky good this year and making three finals already here in 2024, Adelaide, Abu Dhabi, Charleston, all pretty solid fields, by the way. I mean, that's just a ridiculous run for Danielle Collins. She dropped one set on her way to the title, and in dropping that set 6-1, that was the only time she was pushed beyond 6-4 by an opponent in any set that she played. She was broken just three times in her final four matches on her way to the title, which faced just two break points against, I'll say, one of the 10 best returners. She has to be one of the 10 best returners given how her second serve floats in Daria Kasatkina we have in the women's game. Collins made just 49% of her first serves in the final and won 95%, 95% of her first serve points. I mean, a 2-1. 2-1 final in what was a 13th match in a three-week stretch that was felt like a coronation more than anything else. To watch her take second serve returns, rip down the line, ripped cross court, every backhand it feels like she touches as a return of serve is going exactly where she wants it right now. I have never seen Danielle Collins hit the on-the-run forehand cross court in particular better than she has hit over the course of these last 3 weeks. And given how heavy that forehand cross comes in, given how hard that forehand cross comes in, I mean, she had Kasatkina frozen in that corner. She had Maria Sakkari scratching and clawing out of every corner as well. That Sakkari made that match 3-3 is a testament to the fact, and I'm going to double down for my take from last week's show with Jeff Sackman, that Maria Sakkari is back to being a top eight player. Like, that's another semifinal for her. For her to go finals Indian Wells, quarterfinals Miami, lost to Rybakina in three. Now, semifinals Charleston, played Collins about as well as anyone throughout the course of the week. Like, Maria Sakkari is back to playing her best tennis, which 10,000 foot view I think is a really good thing for the WTA Tour, because her combination of physicality and plus one aggression is just a nice contrast, or it's just a nice combination of skills to have thrown into the mix against everyone moving forward in big events. But like, again, that match was never in doubt, and you can just like, you can sense, this is something where you have to watch the matches, and I wish I could say like, oh, you'll see it best at 3-2, 40-30, but you can just, it's a prevailing sense that you gain over the course of watching 20 minutes of any of these matches, let alone 40 an hour. All of Collins' opponents are just frozen because you just don't know what way she's going to go right now. Is she going to open up that left shoulder and turn things backhand line, or open up that right hip and kind of go backhand line? Is she just going to overwhelm you with some sort of cross-court angle that has you stretch so far out the court that, again, she has the 7 feet of requisite space you need on clay to take that line of, you know, she doesn't need seven feet right now. She only needs 3 inches of space to blitz a ball by you. Every return of serve is inside the baseline. Your weight is just pushed forward, backwards on these clay courts when facing, on any surface right now, when facing her. And again, given how difficult it is to recover, particularly if you anticipate in a wrong direction on these clay courts, and you have to anticipate against Collins, because if you don't make a move beforehand, you're just not going to track the ball down, or you're going to float a slice, and then she's going to kill you on the next shot as well. Her inside-out forehand, so heavy right now. I mean, again, just like any match you want to pick. And the thing Ons Jabeur did so well, maybe better than any opponent was able to do, is get the ball out of Collins' strike zone, but do that with depth. It felt like her backhand slice was disrupting the rhythm of the Collins' backhand a little bit, or at least forcing her to pop things up in a way that, you know, Kasatkina's backhand slices just kind of floated a little bit in this match. And part of that was because Kasatkina was just so far on the stretch in the outer thirds that she couldn't really knife the backhand slice in an aggressive sort of manner. You know, again, when Kasatkina gets pushed, she kind of throws up high and heavy, and There's nothing Danielle Collins likes more than hitting a swing and volley out of the air and taking a big cut, and she did that with plenty of success as well. It was overwhelming. It was first strike. It was dominant, and we've seen it for 3 weeks consecutive now. And again, in this three-week run, not only 13 consecutive matches, but you look for her against top 20 opponents, 5-0 against the top 20. You look for her against the top 10 during this stretch, 3-1. And I should have said 5-0. I should have said 5-1 and 3-1 against top 20, top 10 opponents, respectively. The one loss, of course, to Iga at Indian Wells, but I will still contend those first six games of the match, and Collins had break points to go up 4-3. That was as closely as anyone played Iga on her way to that Indian Wells title run. And, you know, again, little factoids like that matter when you look that Collins went from actually pushing Iga for 40 minutes, or at least which was as much as anyone could push her at Indian Wells, to now 13 consecutive matches. Kind of makes you think, oh yeah, like, okay, that level was real. And when you're not facing down the barrel of Iga Swiatek, you know, when the ball's not coming back as hard and heavy, and she has that outer third dexterity, very few, if any, players can produce what Iga, obviously, maybe no one can produce what Iga can produce right now. Anyways, we're not making this an Iga tangent right now. We're focusing on Danielle Collins, and it's the context of it all. It just feels like, and her game always requires confidence when you're hitting that heavy, when you're playing make or break tennis, when you're playing on your terms, when you're trying to dictate, you need the confidence to do that. But there's just a freedom element, it seems like, that is now a mental freedom, perhaps, that comes into it when you just watch how comfortably she's swinging through the court, how she's, you know, again, she's going for exactly what she wants to go for. And you can do that when you've won 13 consecutive matches. Certainly, you have the confidence to do so, but maybe it's the freedom of knowing, hey, the finish line is in sight. Let's just have fun. Let's enjoy this. Let's go out on my terms. And that's the biggest prevailing theme. Everything has been on Danielle Collins' terms. And again, in terms of her plus one success, it just felt like every opponent was pushed back or was hitting on the stretch, wasn't hitting with their feet set unless they executed a perfect first serve, a perfect plus one. If you weren't doing that, Collins was feasting. And she feasts in particular so well on second serves. Jeff wrote a fantastic piece, Jeff Sackman, and for his Heavy Topspin blog on Tennis Abstract, writing about how statistically her aggression on that second serve return, her make-or-break success, how that dictates her success in matches she plays and how that compares to the rest of the field and how that aggressiveness separates her from the rest of the field. But again, like, Jabeur kind of disrupted her strike zone for a little bit, and you almost could tell. And by the way, I also think this is a mental note, and I can't quantify this, but this is just a take of having played 2 weeks in a row in my life before and having followed the tour now and seeing these sorts of things. Like, you do hit that breakpoint threshold where, okay, she wins Miami, she comes to Charleston, she wins her first match against Bedosa. Now she goes down a break in that second set after winning the first. You could tell there was a moment in her mind where it's, you know what, I've had a really good run. Is this where I let this run go to waste, or do I try to power through that moment? And you could tell her powering through that third set, and again, Danielle Collins, as fierce as they come, as mentally tough as they come, dating back to her college career, two-time NCAA champion, transfers after her freshman year from Florida to Virginia, and then goes on to all of that success, like, speaks to her mental fortitude. You could tell in that moment, she's like, you know what? I'm going for it this week. I think I can sustain this level. I think I have enough gas left in the tank. And no one is going to enjoy having the week off now between now and the start of Stuttgart more than Danielle Collins. But with this run, Collins is back up to 15 in the live ranking. She had fallen outside of the top 50 after her first few weeks of the season. Now she's back up to 15 in the live rankings. She's fourth in the points race right now. Swiatek won, Rybakina 2, Sabalenka 3, Collins 4th, above Australian Open finalist Jung Chin Wen, above semifinalist at Indian Wells, as well as Australian Open semifinalist Coco Gauff, above 1,000-level champion Paolini, but of course Collins, I guess, has a 1,000-level title for herself, but like above Sakkari, Kasatkina in her three finals, all the winning Emma Navarro has done. No. 26-7, including qualifying, and 22 tour-level main draw victories, which ties her, by the way, with Rybakina, with Swiatek, for the most of any player this season. Now, you look for Danielle Collins after this week. She's currently sitting at 13th in holds percentage, but you look for her right now, Danielle Collins, seventh, in break percentage. Like, she's holding 74% of the time to start the year, which is a career high by far for Collins. And you look at her career average, it's 5% or 4.6%, above her career average. Breaking 42.4% of the time, that's 6% above her career average. And this is her final season of her career. Again, it just comes down to the freedom. She's always had this plus power. She's a slam finalist and another slam semifinal on top of that as well. We know when Danielle Collins peaks how successful it can be. Heck, I would even turn to, and I know this is not Miami Charleston. I mentioned the 5 top 20 wins, 3 top 10 wins she's had during this stretch. She didn't do that in 2021, but I would remind all of you of what she did July, August of 2021, where she goes semifinals Budapest, wins Palermo, wins San Jose back-to-back as well. So what, won 13 of 14 matches during that stretch, then made round of 16 actually in Montreal before getting knocked out by Pegula. Now, during that run, her only top 20 victory was two top 20 victories, Rybakina and Daria Kasatkina. She did get a win over Sloane Stephens during that stretch as well. Good win over Shelby Rogers, Jung Shui, who was playing well back in 2021 then as well. Again, like, she's won 13 out of 14, but never 13 in a row, never in 1,500-level events, and not back-to-back either, across surfaces. It's a remarkable run for someone in her final season on the job. Danielle Collins is the story right now in women's tennis. Again, if you wanted to say she's the third-best player in the world right now, I would listen to you. If you're going to put her second over Sabalenka because of Sabalenka's sunshine swing troubles, all I'm going to say to you is 6 straight slam semifinals or better. And I think I win the argument because, come on, that's 18 months of slam success versus 3 weeks of 1,500-level success. But I'll listen to third. If you want to make a case for her over Goff, what the ceilings have been this year, I don't know. Like, Rybakina, obviously her, I should have said Rybakina probably first. I still think Rybakina's peak, that Adelaide final from the first week, or Brisbane final, wherever it was, between her and Sabalenka, is the best tennis I've seen from anyone on the WTA Tour all year, including Iga in Indian Wells. But, man, Collins is right there just because she takes the ball off her opponent's rackets. It just has, they've all felt helpless. It felt like no opponent has had the requisite weapons needed to disrupt Collins' rhythm. And if you can't disrupt her rhythm and she is in form and landing her ground strokes with this sort of success, like, again, she made less than 50% of her first serves in the final, and she lost 3 games in the final. There's your story of the week from Charleston. Danielle Collins, 13 consecutive victories, back into the top 15. Is she the third best player in the world right now? Certainly feels like it. An indoor clay in Stuttgart, why couldn't she, if the draw breaks right, make a quarterfinal, semifinal run? What if Danielle Collins in her final year makes her first tour-level finals? That would be a story. Like, again, in my Tennis Hall of Fame remodeling, I'm not saying Danielle Collins is a Hall of Famer. One slam final, didn't win it, one 1,000-level title, fewer than 10 titles overall in her career, not a top 5 career high, no Olympics, you know, medal success that we can all point to or whatever as well. I don't think she's a Hall of Famer. But I do think in terms of, like, best last seasons of someone's career, someone should be cataloging that in the Tennis Hall of Fame. If that's where we go to learn the history of the sport, who had the best last seasons? And all I'm saying is at 26-7, 13 straight victories, 4th in the points race, 3 months and 8 days into the year, I'm ready to ask the question for the first time, is Danielle Collins having the best final season of anyone in the modern era? Modern era. It's got to be after 1995. If I'm not born, it don't count. That's not true. If you can, I'm sure there are some really good, like, Pancho, or whatever, like, Fred Perry finished his career with 3 slams, and then he went off to fight the war. Like, I'm sure there are some I'm forgetting. But you know where to find me, at AL Gruskin on Twitter. Best last seasons in recent memory. Sampras goes out, obviously, with the O2 US Open run, so that is the first one that came to mind for me in terms of competition for him. The thing is, Danielle Collins, it feels like she's going to be able to play a full season. And like, if her last season is her best season of her career, what other players' last season were their best seasons of their career? I guess that's probably the better conversation point to have as it relates to her success. Anyways, we got five more, six more, seven more maybe months if she really does make an ATP, WTA, excuse me, tour finals run of Danielle Collins to enjoy. But man, is she the storyline right now? Champion in Charleston. By the way, I know I already threw this out loosely, but Daria Kasatkina is off to a really good start to her 2024 season, 16-9 overall. I know she loses second round at Australian Open, but it was three sets to Sloane Stephens. What else has she done? Quarterfinals Brisbane, week one of the season, loses to eventual finalist Sabalenka. No shame in that game. Sabalenka lost one match that entire first month. Adelaide, she makes the finals of. Now, she got two withdrawals, so how much do you count that final? I don't know. She lost to Ostapenko. Not a bad loss. The Stevens loss in three, whatever, but then she goes to Abu Dhabi, makes the final, loses to Rybakina. Rest of the Middle East run, Bronzetti, Pavlyuchenkova losses, forgettable. Round of 16 Indian Wells. Disappointing second round loss in Miami to Kirsteia, but then finals, Charleston, where she beats Kalinina Pegula 7-6 in the third on her way to that final with Collins. Like, again, you look for her this year so far against top 50 players, 8-8, top 20 players, 2-3, top 10 players, 1-2. Okay, that's not particularly notable. She is still top 15, top 10, to be specific, in break percentage, still over that 40% threshold, which measures the elite returners. Again, 50% threshold as a break percentage. I know I talk about that so frequently because that's where Iga flirts with. That's all time. That's Pantheon. That's what are we doing? If you are over 40%, you know, I always say on the 90% side of the men's, that's the John Isner equivalent. Oh, if you're over 40% break percentage on the WTA Tour, that's elite. That is the best of the best returners we have in the women's game, and that's who Kasatkina has been now for four consecutive seasons leading into this year. Again, three finals under her belt to start this season. Daria Kasatkina, despite the early exits in Indian Wells, Miami, and the Australian Open, she's 10th right now in the points race. She has flirted with WTA final status now for three straight years. Like, I constantly underrate her because I do think the players with the bigger weapons and the requisite consistency, physicality to face her, I will favor them every time because they will just have the opportunity to dictate play. But again, she's so scrappy. She moves so well, improvises so well, finds angles so well, is going after her forehand. There's just a little bit more chutzpah behind it than there has been in the past. And that was a really good win because Pegula threw everything at her. Pegula was willing to make that match a track meet, and it was Kasatkina who finds that 7-6 third set victory in the semifinal. Good win over a very much playing confidently, swinging freely, Jacqueline Christiane in the quarterfinals as well. Heck, the Kalinina win in round three, as I alluded to, a good one for Kasatkina. Sneaky third final of the year. Does she have a title? No. But third final of the year for her, and you know, again, 10th in the points race, entering a clay court swing where she has traditionally been had her most success. I mean, Daria Kasatkina, honestly, has been pretty consistent across surfaces, but the highlight results, I suppose, have come on clay for her. So you keep that in mind. You know, I already mentioned Maria Sakkari. Talk about a three-week stretch, this first run with Dave Witt, finals Indian Wells, quarters Miami, semis Charleston, but a good 2-4 win over Veronika Kudermetova that was never really in doubt. Collins put together a special performance. Like, yeah, you would have loved to see Sakkari find a little bit more. You know, she didn't serve particularly well, made just 56% of her first serves. I think it was seven double faults in the match. Now she felt some serious pressure to go big on the second serve because Collins was feasting on second serve return, so I don't actually hate that number from a strategic standpoint. Sakkari's back in top eight form. I'm just going to reiterate. She comes out of this North American swing having gained as much confidence as any human not named Danielle Collins. Like, I actually think that's a fair point to make because Iga was always Iga, regardless of what happened at Indian Wells. But Sakkari, I actually think, is who you'd put number two on the power rankings. Collins, for obvious reasons, is number one. But who else has been better over that three tournament stretch? No one. No one better than Maria Sakkari. She's just back in the mix and goes into this clay court swing. 6 right now in the rankings, 11th right now in the points race. And again, talk about someone who struggled out of the gates to start the year, has settled the ship and made the course correction. For Jessica Pegula, Sakkari 0.8. Like, disappointing Indian Wells, and obviously, but San Diego semifinals, got a couple wins there. Miami quarterfinal, good win over Navarro, good win over Fernandez. Got a very impressive 7-6 third in the got two very impressive 7-6 third set victories, in Charleston over Amanda Nisimova, who, when healthy, still plays top 50 tennis, top 25 tennis. Like, I'm still the biggest believer in Amanda Nisimova. It's just, what does she want her tennis career to be, I suppose, is the open question. But for Pegula to get 2-7-6 in the third wins over two power-centric players in Anisimova, Azarenka, kind of shows the juices back. Really hard to go 3-0 in deciding set tiebreakers, over the course of the week. So she lost the third against Kasatkina, probably the one you would have favored her most in. And yet, you know, again, she had played 2.5 hours the day before against Vika. 2 hours, 47 minutes was the fight against Kasatkina. The season is now back in the B's. It's a B- right now for Jessica Pegula. But she, it's probably still a C+, honestly, when you look at the big picture of the year because of what she just, that window of slam titles is felt open for her over these last 2.5 years. And if that window's closed, how could you not inevitably be disappointed? But in terms of her level coming out of this North American swing, given how disappointing the first month of the year was for her, yeah, you're just feeling, I think she's back to top 20 form. Certainly, even if I don't quite see the gusto behind the ground strokes in a way they were there certainly in 22 and 23. Still, it was a really fun Charleston event, a loaded 500-level draw. Again, by the way, shout-out to Vika, another quarterfinal for Victoria Azarenka, who very quietly right now in the points rate, sitting up at 14. Another sneaky good quarterfinal for Elisa Mertens, who is currently sitting at 22 in the points race. Obviously for Jacqueline Christiane, who has been fighting to get back inside the top 100 after dealing with a bunch of injuries. She makes this 500-level quarterfinal, the 25-year-old back up to number 74. Big run for her. Kudermetova finally got 2 wins at an event. Oh my God, did she need that coming into a massive clay court season with, she's got a ton of points to defend. It was a really fun event. In Taylor Townsend, new career high after she reaches round 3 of this event. I know Navarro, disappointing loss certainly to Christiane in 3 sets, but I was very impressed with her round 1, her first match victory over over Katie Valinets. Again, like, you know the storylines now. Everything that unfolded in Charleston, that was your big event on the green clay. I don't mind the green clay. I think things move a little bit quicker. It's definitely a little bit more slick, a little bit more sleek. You would like things to get a little grittier, certainly, but we got plenty of time for that on the European clay. I don't mind this, as I dare I say, soft transition from the hard courts to the clay court surface. And again, it's the only green clay we get all year. I don't mind a little surface variety. So that was everything we saw unfold in Charleston. We'll get back to the WTA Bogota event at the end of today's show. Let's move over now to everything we saw on the ATP side of things. Here's a sentence I didn't expect to say. Ben Shelton, a 2024 ATP Tour clay court champion. That's where I want to start our look at week one on the ATP side of things, because watching Ben serve and volley his way to success in Houston, it just felt notable, and it's indicative of the remarkable plus one talent this young American possesses. And again, whenever I talk Ben Shelton, I can't help but start to think about watching him play 2021 as a freshman, and to see it was a little bit erratic, and yet you could hear the ball coming off of his racket. I've told this story before. I had a coach come up to me and say, I'm telling you, Ben Shelton has much higher upside than Denis Shapovalov. And he told me that 2021, Ben was a freshman. Shapovalov was still probably one of the 5 most promising prospects we had on the ATP Tour at that time. And I was just like, you're absolutely crazy, coach, for making that statement and saying that out loud with such confidence. And you know, 3 years later, I'm the one who's eating crow. Like, to just watch Ben serve and volley his way so fluidly, to see how easy the high backhand volley is for him. No human should be able to pronate through that ball with the sort of fluidity and power and place and feel and just how well he hits that ball for someone who is still 21 freaking years old. That is just indicative of the coordination he possesses, the strength he possesses, the explosiveness he possesses. I mean, the first serve all week long, you know, he was never broken more than twice in a match, and he got broken twice in that Zizou Bergs match, but then 7 of 7 in facing break points against Nakashima, faced just 3 against Echeverry, faced just 2 against Tiafo, and, you know, in the one set he was broken, yeah, he lost that set, but 7-5, 4-6, 6-3 win over Tiafo in that final. Look, it's glass half full, glass half empty. You can do two approaches to this. Let's do the glass half empty real quick. There were moments where Ben's backhand was just a liability on the clay courts. I mean, there were times when Tomas Martin Echeverry, I think he went like seven, he must have gone seven service game stretch from the start of middle of the first set to the middle of the second set, where it felt like he lost maybe 4 points behind his first serve, or like 5 points total on serve during the course of his service games, where it just felt like, you know, yeah, Ben might get hot and rip a return winner on one of those points, but Echeverry slice serve wide on the deuce side, plus one ball into the open space, make Ben hit a running forehand, move forward behind that forehand into the open space, by the way, as well for Echeverry. You know, add side, T serve into the backhand, plus one inside out, second forehand cross court, make Ben hit a running backhand. You just knew exactly what pattern was coming for Echeverry and how easy it was for him to get into those patterns in a bunch of his service games. Certainly notable as Ben makes the transition to even grittier clay courts in Europe. And, you know, again, the Houston clay is a little bit weird, but oh my God, as easy as things were for Echeverry, credit to Ben, like just the pop on his first serve, how heavy that ball comes in, how fearful you are of hitting to his forehand and leaving something popped up. Because, yeah, Ben's forehand certainly maybe the more erratic of the two wings right now. But, oh, my God, like he and I've said this before in analyzing Ben, why I was so excited for his clay court season, because now he does have 15 months of matches under his belt and just far more ATP tennis wherewithal and know-how of how to construct points, what to expect coming back at you. Now that he's a little bit more comfortable with the timing, the rhythm, the pace of everything, watching him just flick forehands with his wrist at will, when he changes direction and you don't expect it with his forehand on this clay, I don't know how you're tracking that ball down, because it's such a heavy topspin shot that it just rips through the court. Again, if you chip a return, he's serving and volleying, and the depth, the pace of his first volleys, you just have such a difficult pass in front of you, and unless you rip a winner on that pass, all Ben has to do is make the second volley because your positioning is so compromised by his first one. I mean, it's just amazing how easy life is for Ben, even on this surface. And look, again, it wasn't the Monte Carlo draw. You look at his wins, Nakashima's outside the top 50. Yeah, Echeverry, a quarterfinalist at the French Open last year. Francis Tiafo, winner of Houston last year. But I don't think either Tiafo or Echeverry would be in the B-plus category, maybe even not the B category in terms of what you'd give them for their grades through the first third of the 2024 season. But on his way to this first clay court title and his second title of his career at the tour level, Ben beat both the reigning Houston finalist in Echeverry in the semis and the reigning champion, Francis Tiafo in the final. Beat him both in 3 sets as well in his first serve, his first forehand or the serve and volley combination. His first strike tennis was the most successful weapon and the biggest weapon on the court in each of those matches. And again, boy, some of his backhand block returns are just going to be a problem. He is going to be sprinting on these clay courts, because there were times when, again, that backhand would just sit up. It would float there for Echeverry to tee off on, for Tiafo to attack. I did think, you know, again, the problem for Francis was Ben's serve into Francis' forehand. It just gave Ben easy plus one opportunities to attack. It allowed him to stay on script pretty steadily. But man, there were times when Francis was driving through his backhand so well. To watch Francis dominate with his first serve, dominate with the same sort of plus one aggression against Dardari, who, by the way, very good week for Luciano Dardari, who kind of proves, hey, you know, my run in South America was real. Like, he goes, you know, again, wins his first ATP title in South America, now a semifinal here to start in Houston. It's just kind of, you have to keep our eye on the young Italian, who's now up to a new career high, 63 in the live rankings as a result of this semifinal. But I can't believe how successful Ben's plus, you know, again, it's not John Isner, because Ben moves so well in and out of corners because he does have those improvisational skills where he will snap a forehand pass by you down the line, or snap one by you cross, or get a slice bump lob over your head. And now he's moving forward with all of his athleticism, and God, does he close things out at the net so successfully. And, you know, you think you can drop shot him, but then he's going to, you know, track that drop shot down and give you a little flick of the wrist cross court or whatever it may be. Like, it's just, it's really impressive, and it speaks to, as he gains more consistency, the return of serve will always be something he needs to continue to improve on. But as he does continue to improve on that return of serve, and you can already see, again, the forehand return, the backhand, he swings through it more comfortably. It does feel like there's better depth on it at times, although, again, there were some times when the backhand was just floating. Very easy to attack for his opponents in Houston. Still, the forehand does feel more controlled. It also feels heavier. It just, his weapons are going to work on this surface. He has the exact sort of explosive, his explosiveness feels amplified that much more on this surface. And again, that's a really good run for him to get his clay court season started. For Francis, first final of the year. And after a really disappointing Sunshine Swing where he loses second match in Indian Wells, first match Miami, had to feel good for him at an event where, again, he was the defending champion, to at least get back to the finals and not lose all of the points. And, you know, by the way, Tiafoe currently sitting outside the top 20s at 23 in the live rankings. Ben, with his run to the title and Fritz losing early in Monte Carlo, he's going to be the highest-ranked American for the first time in his career. He's going to end the run of Taylor Fritz, who's fallen to number 14 now in the live rankings. Shelton all the way up to number 13. New career high for the 21-year-old. By the way, he's the second youngest player in the top 15. Second youngest in the top 13, if you want to be specific. Only Alcaraz is younger than Ben Shelton. Second youngest player in the top, 25, I believe, overall. Second youngest player in the top 30. You have to go all the way to number 36 in Arthur Fee to find another player other than Alcaraz younger than Ben Shelton right now up there in the rankings. And I have said this before, I will say it again. He has nothing to defend the rest of this clay court season. He has one quarterfinal from last year that he reached, a semifinal at the challenger level in Cagliari. He won one match in Barcelona. He won one match at Queen's Club. He won one match at Wimbledon. And then he won one match in Canada, one match in Cincinnati. He has seven total wins to defend before the start of the U.S. Open. Who wants to bet between now and then Ben Shelton wins more than seven matches? If I put, like, everyone wants to bet that. There is a legitimate runway. Let me say that again. There is a legitimate runway for Ben Shelton to make a top 10 push, because he's 13 in the rankings right now, and he has nothing to defend until that U.S. Open semifinal. Now, there's a significant gap. Right now, he trails number 10, Alex Diemenauer, by just under 900 points. But he's got nothing to defend. Not that Demon's got a ton to defend either in the clay, but grass court in particular, you don't think Ben can rip off a semifinal or a final run in an Eastbourne or a Queen's Club where his serve gets hot, he's serving and volleying well, like certainly a round three, a hold seed performance behind his serve at Wimbledon. You know, right now Ben has worked his way up. You look at the in terms of 2024 specific stats, Ben Shelton now all the way up to number 11 in holds percentage on the ATP Tour. He's held serve 87.6% of the time to start this season, and that speaks to the consistency he has now found behind the plus one. Anyways, Ben's really good. In case you didn't know, he's going to be the top-ranked American man to start next week. Obviously, for Francis, again, needed that final. Dardari, your second biggest winner, just for him to get another semifinal at the tour level under his belt, new career high. And by the way, big for Echeverry to get things going. Obviously, he's got some significant points to defend coming up. That was Houston. But Ben Shelton wasn't your only first ATP clay court winning, first time ATP clay court title winner on the week. Let's try that sentence again in English. No rewound sound effect necessary because I'm trying to make life easy for our super producer, Daniel Westhoff. But Ben Shelton was not your only first-time winner on the ATP Tour this week on the clay courts. No, Hoopy Hercotz joined him in the winner's circle for the first time on the dirt, and I believe you look for Hoopy Hercotz in his career entering this week in Estoril. He hadn't made a clay court final since the Poznan Challenger in June of 2018. Only two clay court finals in his career, that Challenger and a Czech Republic Futures back in 2016. Those were the only clay court finals in the career of Hoopy Hercotz entering the week. Now he wins the title in Estoril, drops. Does Hoopy just no sets on his way to that title run? One set, excuse me, to Christian Garin, the second. But again, Westhoff, leave that in. Apologies, I would redo the whole segment. But again, Westhoff's done a lot of coding of late. He's been killing it on our college tennis broadcast. So I'm trying to make these podcasts as easy for him as possible. Anyways, the big number for Hoopy Hercotz, you look for him throughout the course of the week. First of all, in his four total victories, he faced a total of 24 break points overall. He was broken just four times, fought off 20 of the 24 break points that he faced. Didn't face a single break point in what was the most lopsided final I've seen of the season. I know Collins beat Casacchino 1 and 2, but within 15 minutes of that Hercotz-Pedro Martinez match, there was just probably the most lopsided men's final I've seen of the year. It was just every time Pedro Martinez floated a backhand slice, Hercotz was on top of it, closing things off at the net, snapping off a forehand volley, snapping off a backhand volley, just taking every second of time, excuse me, offered to him. His backhand down the line was absolute money in this match as well. And again, it felt like he was bunting down on the forehand. It does feel like with the progress he's made on his forehand on the hard courts, you give him a little bit more time to hit that ball on the clay, as this surface will provide him. I actually do think with how well Hoopy moves, how fluid he is, yes, his backhand is traditionally flat, but how well he was ripping it through the court, there was just, felt like an added 10 miles per hour of pace on it. Felt like every heavy topspin inside-out forehand was just sitting up right in his strike zone. But it was the progress on the forehand in particular that allowed him, in my opinion, to have this sort of success. Now, it wasn't the toughest run to the final either. Didn't face a single top 50 player on his run to that title. He should win that event, given Rude's loss to Martinez in three sets in the semis and how the draw broke out. But Hoopy dominated everyone. And to see him do that on this surface, it's just indicative of that fact that his weapons have now reached a caliber where he's just an unequivocal top 12 player. Like, there's a reason right now you look at the rankings, Hoopy Hercotz sits at 10 overall in the live ranking. Excuse me, he's at 7 in the live rankings right now, 7 in the points race as well. That's correct. Like, Hoopy Hercotz is in that. Again, we talked about this with David Kane last week, but that, you know, post Zverev at number 5, and probably Dimitrov after Miami was that definitive 6. But like anywhere from Dimitrov at 6 to, I would go Hercotz at 10. And I'd include Rublev, Rude, Demonauer, and maybe Holger Rune in that conversation as well. That right now is your inner circle race for who are going to get those final spots at the ATP Tour Finals. It feels like if Djokovic plays a full season, he, Alcaraz, Sinner, Medvedev, Zverev, I would pencil them in right now as 5 members who will certainly be in the field. It's a fight for the final 3 spots, and Hoopy is absolutely in that fight. And given it feels like no, you know, American men have receded from that fight, none of Paul pre-injury might have been in it more than Fritz or Tiafo, Shelton, Korda so far to this year. Like, again, feels like we're in a 5-6 guy race for 3 spots right now, and it's crazy that the field feels that clear this early in the year. And certainly there will always be someone who pops up and emerges as a candidate we're not talking about right now. But man, Hoopy has firmly ensconced himself in that discussion. He was dominant. I've never seen him bunt down on forehands in such a successful manner on this surface. And boy, is that a terrifying prospect for opponents moving forward, because, again, he finds space. He moves so well. He's creative. He finds outer thirds. He plays drop shots. There's a physicality. He can bring the requisite physicality needed to find success on this surface. If he starts to get belief on this surface now as well, following this title run in Estoril, look out rest of the field. A massive run for Hubi Hurkacz. Again, first career clay court title at the tour level. Huge run for the 26-year-old Pedro Martinez as well. Longtime listeners of this show know I've always been a believer in his game on this surface. The physicality he brings, he likes to knife the backhand slice, serves and volleys a little bit, love his kick serve as well, but every spot he hit, you know, that high and heavy inside out ball, it just sat up right in the 6'6" Hurkacz's strike zone. And so, and again, every time he sliced a backhand, Hurkacz was moving in, taking that time away and hitting that volley so decisively. It was just a terrible matchup for Martinez, but again, he gets a little revenge. He lost to Casper Ruud in a final in Kitzbühel back in 2021 in three sets. This time he gets the 6-4, 4-6, 6-4 win over Ruud in their, what, 3-hour, 7-minute semifinal battle. I mean, again, just gets him back in the mix. You're 60 in the world. You're going to get into all the 1,000-level clay court events coming up. And that's all Pedro Martinez can ask for, because this is the surface where he makes his living. Again, a massive victory for him over Casper Ruud, who, the backhand got a little leaky. He definitely got a little passive. Did not take advantage of the Martinez slice on the backhand wing to nearly the extent that he should have. But he only made 54.6% of his first serves in that match, after making over 70% of them in his previous four matches and in six out of his last eight. That was one of his worst serving performances I've seen from him this season. And it felt like an exception, not a trend. Like, it was just a bad day at the office service-wise. And again, he still lost that match 6-4 in the third. The forehand is firing. He's just fitter, and he's talked openly about that fact. I'm not hitting the panic meter at all heading into the clay court season for Casper Ruud, as, you know, again, I think he has been one of the eight best players, as I alluded to, through the first third of this 2024 season. That was everything in Estoril. And again, shout out to the semifinalist Casper Ruud, Christian Garin, a Muchie, who talked about how he's finally getting healthy as he reached this semifinal. He's back up to 103 in the rankings, but obviously, a guy, when he's playing his best, we know how good he can be on this surface. And then, by the way, your quarterfinalists, Vucevic, Pablo Lamas Ruiz, Nuno Borges, who, again, hasn't made that many tour-level quarterfinals in his career. For him to do it on home soil, I know how much that means for him. He's up to number 54 in the rankings, 8 off his career high as the former All-American. And then Richard Gasquet, another quarterfinal as well. Gasquet, right on the top 100 bubble, currently sitting at 112 in the rankings, is the 37-year-old. I wonder if Richard Gasquet applies to your tournament. Do you give him a wild card? Because certainly has the pedigree, but does he put butts in seats at this point of his career? Probably not still. That was everything in Estoril. And then on the Marrakesh side of things, there's only one thing to say. Matteo Berrettini's back, and you look to his start to the season, finals in Phoenix. Yeah, where he loses to Nuno in a really fun 5-6 match, but that was his like fourth match in 48 hours or 72 hours, whatever. Loses first round to Murray in Miami that very next day, 2 days later, like a little bit of a schedule loss, but whatever. Now he wins the title in Marrakesh, gets good wins over top 50 clay court guys, top 50 guys overall in Sonego, Shevchenko, but I would say top 50 clay court guys as well in Haumi Munar, in Mariano Navone, who we saw had a breakout South American clay court swing to beat the always lingering, Roberto Carbeas Baena, 5-2 in the final as well. He went down 3-1 a break in that right away in the opening set. And when I say he got the break back for 2-3 so quickly, it just seemed to wake him up. Like, wait, because the first four games, Berrettini just wasn't hitting any forehands. And then he was. And then he was moving his backhand slice so well around the court. And then again, anything that got popped up, he was able to pounce upon. It was his best performance of the week, that 5-2 win, where, again, he got broken in his second service game of the match, then went unbroken the rest of the way, was down love 40 when serving out the set 5-3, when serving out the set 6-5 in the first, and was able to fight his way back after a lucky let court, and you know, again, kind of capitalized on that, found a few big first serves, big plus one forehands. It's just when he's landing that first serve and finding first forehands or middle third forehands where his feet are set, he dictates. You lose. And that's always who Matteo Berrettini has been. Now, this was actually his first title since Queen's Club 2022. Now, obviously, we know a lot of that very injury-centric, but man, that had to feel good for Matteo Berrettini, who, with the victory now, I believe, up to 84 in the rankings. Now, he'll fall off a little bit with some Monte Carlo points coming off of his record, but that's a guy you give a wild card to because you swoon over him. He does put butts in seats and, again, also so well regarded amongst his peers. Anyways, I know he got pushed a bunch of times, and a big result for Mariano Navone, who, again, for those of you unfamiliar with the 22-year-old, now 23-year-old, excuse me, Argentinian, he's up to a new career high, number 51 now in the live rankings. Backhand moves well around the court. Again, just such a tough out physically. Second career semifinal at the tour level, obviously. He made the final in Rio back in February. He's 51 in the live in the rankings. It's new career high. For a guy who I guarantee you, I know I haven't spent more than an hour thinking about Mariano Navone throughout his tennis career, and it's something I'm looking forward to doing more of, learning more about him as he gets these shots against the big dogs here on the clay courts. Because, again, the first impression of the tour level success he has had, and when I say less than an hour, I mean thinking about, I'm well aware of who Mariano Navone is. I'm saying thinking about his place in the broader ecosystem moving forward. He's earned a place in at least consideration in, okay, who is this guy and how much do I need to be, you know, again. I kind of thought Echeverry was always lingering and that French Open quarterfinal would someday be within him. Do I need to start considering that about Mariano Navone? Certainly feels like through the first few months of this 2024 clay court season, he has elevated himself into that level of conversation. By the way, big final run for Carbeas Baena, who was defending title points in Marrakesh, and to get to the final again keeps him in the top 100, top 75 conversation, number 72 right now, a guy who will certainly be looking forward to getting into these big 1,000 level clay court events coming up. So big winner, certainly Matteo Berrettini coming back in, Carbeas Baena reaching the final, and then semifinalist Navone, Pavel Kotov, who, by the way, just sneaky 25-year-old top 75 player for quite some time now. Your quarterfinalist, Sonego. Big quarterfinal run for Alex Vukic, never a guy who had that much success on the clay courts. 28-year-old, 66 in the live rankings, top 100 spot consolidated. Huge run for the qualifier, Moreno de Alboron, the former UCSB gacho. I believe that's his first tour-level quarterfinal, and with the run, he's sitting at 139 in the live rankings. Fognini, your other quarterfinalist, he's trying to make a push back into the top 100 and does, up to number 94 as a result of this success. That's everything from week one of the 2024 ATP clay court season. Last but not least here again, it's just so special, and you can see the emotion on her face every match she plays, just the joy, the thrill for 22-year-old Cami Osorio to get to compete in her home country, compete in Bogota, and, you know, again, for the second time in her career, Osorio, the Bogota champion, she knocks out Bojkova 3-6 in the title. Knocks out each of the top two seeds, Bojkova and Tatiana Maria, excuse me, on her way to that title run. You know, it was never pushed over 2 hours, even though she was pushed to three sets once in this title run with the run Osorio all the way back up to number 63 now in the live rankings for someone who, you know, again, her forehand rips through these clay courts, the drop shots, the angles she plays, the return of serve, and her ability to be on her front foot, how comfortable she is sliding on these courts as well from a movement perspective. To get this sort of confidence boost, to get this sort of rankings jolt, it's just perfect for her heading into the European clay court swing. By the way, this was a huge week for Marie Bojkova as well. Talk about a forgettable first third of 2024. She made a quarterfinal in Auckland week one of the season. For Bojkova, this was her first quarterfinal since. It's her first final of the year, first final since October of last year. Again, keeps her in the top 50, certainly. And you look for Bojkova with this run. She's actually back up to number 35 in the live rankings. she just couldn't hit through the court the way Cami Osorio could. Cami Osorio's forehand was the biggest weapon in every match that she played. And again, when she's dictating that forehand, moving it around the court, inside out, down the line, inside in, all these different things, it opens up the drop shot for her. And that's when she's at her most effective, when she gets you chasing, when she's finding the angles, when she's cutting things off at the net. It was a big week for Cami Osorio, who, again, has kind of fallen out of that top tier. And I'm not sure if she ever was quite in it, but it felt like she was a tier two. It's certainly no lower than a tier three young prospect early in her career when she won that 2021 Bogota title and was just breaking through and had all this junior success. And again, how the ball just flies off of her strings. You're like, ooh, who is this now moving forward? You know, again, with the rise of players like Chin Wen and Navarro, Noskova, the resurgence of players like Kostyuk, Fernandez, I don't think I'd ever put Osorio above them in the conversation, but should she be a top 50 player for the majority of her prime? I think the weapons, the physicality, the creativity certainly would say yes. And again, this was just a big run for her to right the ship, reach the final in Bogota. Again, Bojkova, your semifinalist. Bojkova, your finalist. Irani, Rakimova, your semifinalist. And then again, a shout out to our quarterfinalists as well. In this draw, you had Tatiana Maria, Laura Siegemund, you had Christina Buxa, as well as Irina Barra. That was your 250 level in Bogota. Of course, shout out to the 150 champion over in Spain. 125 champion Maria Carla, the 24-year-old who rises to a new career high, number 84, as a result of her run at that 125K. Knocks out Rebecca Masarova in the final there. Semifinalist Danilovic and Galfi. Quarterfinalist Sonmez, Selekmeteva, Jacquimo, and Remkova. That was everything from week one of the 2024 clay court season. Now, of course, it's a one-week event here in week two, but that means we get to lock in on everything that's happening in Monte Carlo. On tomorrow's show, I will not only recap what's unfolded in the early action, I will also preview the rest of the draw for you listeners moving forward. A shout out and thank you, as always, to our super producer, Daniel Westoff, for the of an editing job he does day in, day out, making all of our content possible. A shout out as well to the support we get from our dear friends at Tennis Point, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15. With all that said, for our fantastic super producer, Daniel Westoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Crack Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. That's the break. We'll talk to you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.